The views expressed throughout this podcast are solely those of myself and the guest and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of ATCC or any other institution. Hello, and welcome to Behind the Biology, brought to you by ATCC. I'm your host, Dave Yarmush, and this is our second episode in our series with Dr. Tasha Santiago Rodriguez. As per usual, I recommend listening to the first episode to learn more about what she researches and how. Today, however, we showcase Tasha's journey from studying bacteriophages in the wet lab to diving headfirst into bioinformatics and data science. Tasha's experiences shed light on her seamless transition from the wet lab world of bench science into data manipulation and the insights gained. Hi, Tasha. Welcome back.
Thanks for
coming back again. As you know, in this episode, we talk a little bit more about how something fundamentally changed in your career. And for instance, I didn't start as a bioinformatician. I didn't know what it was until I basically made the decision to become one. And I'm kind of curious if you had a similar path.
Yeah, I think that happened to me too. So maybe I can give a little bit of background about my PhD and how I transitioned to data science and bioinformatics. So my PhD, as probably many, many people, had nothing to do with bioinformatics and data science. So I started working with bacteriophages, as I mentioned very briefly, and I was trying to characterize them as indicators of human fecal contamination. So that meant that I was working a lot in the wet lab, getting sewage samples, raw sewage samples, treated samples, and even fecal material from different animals like pigs and chickens. Chickens and cattle, just trying to make sure that my bacteriophages were specific to the human GI tract. So my whole PhD was about that, trying to characterize these bacteriophages as indicators of fecal contamination. And it had very little regarding molecular analysis. I did some PCR analysis and amplification, but nothing in the realm of bioinformatics and data science. So then, as I mentioned very briefly in the first episode, I was introduced into the microbiome through Dr. Cano and my PhD advisor and through these collaborations with the archaeology department. That's when we were looking into the microbiomes of these ancient cultures. And even though it wasn't really bioinformatics, it was probably my first experience in working with microbiome and metagenome tools. So back then, I was using MGRAS and ChimeOne, which were the tools that we were using back in 2012, 2013. And that was probably my first experience with bioinformatics and data science and microbiomes. But then it was with my first postdoc that I was really into the topic of bioinformatics and data science, even though I was still working on the bench in the wet lab. It was probably one of my first experiences in doing some type of data manipulation. So even though my postdoc advisor back then will be the one doing the upstream processing of the sequence data, I was the one still getting that data and analyzing the data. And unfortunately, we were using Excel to do all that. But it was just a way to get, you know, what we wanted, like plots and stack bar plots and whatnot. So that was probably my first encounter with data science and data manipulation.
Out of curiosity, real quick, were you doing that all by hand in Excel, or did you end up like starting to write VBA macros to take some of the pressure off?
It was all by hand. We were doing with Excel what we wanted. So actually, I think I started to do more coding in R now in Diversigen, because it was probably we needed to do that. It's probably the only way to make sure that what you're writing, it's someone else can do it as well. It's the only way to have reproducible coding.
Yeah, I 100% agree. We like to joke around here that all roads lead to bioinformatics, because you know, eventually the amount of data you need to work with just becomes so large that you start doing a little bit of Excel, and then you start to do a lot of Excel, and then you start to do a little bit of R or Python or what have you. And before you know it, you wake up one day and you're like, oh, I just write programs now.
Yeah, that's true.
Did it feel like that for you? Is it a natural extension of the PhD work, or did it feel like more of a departure to sort of switch gears into the data science?
I think it was like a transition. Like it felt natural to do it because I was doing, for example, with the postdoc, I was doing all the wet lab analysis and studies. It was almost like a need and a natural transition to do it because I have been working with all this data on the bench, on the wet lab, but then I want to analyze it and see what's happening. So I think it felt very, very natural.
Yeah, I'd like to think it did for me too. It's interesting though, because I do find that every so often my background that I brought to my career, which has nothing to do with bioinformatics, is actually fairly valuable. It changes the way I look at some problems every so often, even though it was fundamentally different. Do you feel like your previous experience, whether it is your bachelor's degree, your PhD, your the postdoc as you were shifting, has really impacted the way you approach the data science?
Yes, I think so. I think mainly as a data scientist, you have to make sure that what you have, it's reproducible somehow. And I feel like this is something you keep an eye on from the early days, like from being a PhD student, a postdoc. I feel like you have that in your thoughts and the way you process the data somehow.
I imagine you've also got a fairly keen mind towards how an experiment should be designed from day one too.
Yeah, I think like now as a data scientist, and this happens, I think anywhere, I look at the data and I ask, where's the mock community? Where's the blank control? This is something that we should have looked at from the very beginning to start with. And at least with skin microbiomes, this is something that we talked about earlier. It's something that is so important in microbiome research as well. Any microbiome research is to make sure that you're adding your blank controls, your mock communities, and all these things. So as a data scientist, and when you analyze your data, you realize that that's probably one of the most important things that you have to do is to make sure that you're adding all these controls and have all these controls in place.
I bet that makes you also a very talented as in your position as the as an editor at Phage Biology.
It's Frontiers in Microbiology, but it's the section Phage Biology. But yeah, it's like you say, when I see a paper, especially a microbiome paper, I usually look at the controls, especially if they're working with low biomass samples like skin, tissue. You always have to look for the controls, especially with low biomass, like I said, because you don't know if any of your microbiome signal comes from your reagents, from your extraction, from mm-hmm. your PCR, from your water. So you have to make sure that you're adding all these controls and have all these controls in place.
Right. That is something that is very easily overlooked. A lot of these reagents are actually biologically derived in the first place. And so they present an opportunity for, you know, a false positive signal.
Yeah, I think actually there are some papers out there that have been published that haven't added a control. And it's kind of sad to look at those and say, is this like a true signal? Is this just from my reagents?
At what point did you start to consider yourself a data scientist? Was it when that was your job title or was it before that?
That's a great question. So at Diversigen, I actually didn't start as a data scientist. I started as a microbiome discovery analyst. So it was kind of a data scientist position, but the actual title started probably 3 years ago. So I think that's when I started to consider myself a data scientist. And I think I consider myself more now that I'm working more with R coding and doing all this coding in R, I think I consider myself more as a data scientist. So it's actually a very recent thing.
How do you find it so far? I mean, it's I've got to guess it's been a long time since I've been in a lab, but the satisfaction of getting success, does it feel different, better, worse?
From being a data scientist from the wet lab, you mean? Or
yeah, exactly.
I feel it's probably I guess it depends. For me, it will be the same. As a data scientist, I think for me, being successful will mean that I analyze the data in a way that other people can understand it. That I probably found the best statistical analysis, and even the smallest things, like trying to make it prettier, the font bigger, or changing colors, like finding the ways to make the results better. I think that's for me success. In the wet lab, it will be probably very similar, like getting amplification, getting virome sequencing data, or DNA from fossilized feces. I think it's also for me considered successful when you do all these things.
Okay, I like that. That makes it kind of like a difference between the discovery of something new. Not that data science doesn't do that. Data science discovers new things all the time.
Yeah.
But a major strength in a talented data scientist is their ability to actually communicate the relevance and provide the evidence that had been, you know, generated somewhere upstream.
Yeah, I think that's a challenge. And if you're able to do it, I think that's, you can consider yourself a successful data scientist. Like, how do you get from a huge table with numbers and samples and bacterial names to something that anyone can understand? That's probably the biggest challenge. And if you're able to do it, that's probably a success.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that is undeniably a massive challenge, both in terms of, you know, communication to people that aren't, you know, explicitly trained in sciences, but even to, you know, other scientists. Just, you know, the names are long and they're complicated. The analyses are sophisticated and difficult, and translating all that to make it easily understandable is, I mean, there's an art to it, at least.
Yeah.
So kind of shifting gears here, but you did, as we spoke about in the last episode, some work with the mummies in Peru, or you said at least South America. Are you continuing to pursue that? Is that something of an active research?
Right now, no. It's something that I stopped doing a couple of years ago. I think because ancient microbiomes, it's not for everyone. And I felt like every time we will publish a paper, there was a letter to the editor saying, oh, what these people did is wrong because of this. And then you had to respond saying, no, we did this. So I think I shifted because mainly of that. But now I do some collaborations with my PhD advisor in ancient DNA, but I am not the main person doing the analysis. So, for example, one of the latest papers about the DNA sequences of plants and the diets of these cultures, it was mainly his PhD student that did all this analysis. So I was just there, probably just helping her with some of the analysis and advising her on some of the analysis that she could do. But for the most part, I'm not directly the person doing ancient microbiome analysis anymore.
What did you take away from those studies that you are still keeping in mind today?
From the ancient microbiome studies?
Yeah, and yeah, we could broaden that out to everything else we've already discussed.
Yeah, you know, I think whenever you do ancient DNA and ancient microbiome, I think it's such a elegant way of showing history somehow. As I mentioned, from these cultures, we have all these archaeological artifacts, but we don't know so many things about them. And I think, like, by through DNA sequencing and microbiome analysis, we're able to know much about these cultures that belong to our history somehow.
Yeah, so I'm going to say we're, but you're filling in the blanks that are left by, you know, centuries and millennia of changes, things getting lost, things not being written down.
Exactly. I feel like I'm part of making history somehow, especially from the region that I come from. I feel like it's such a good way to be part of making history and understanding history that we don't have any records.
How great does it feel to say those sentences? I imagine, you know, 20 years ago, you didn't expect that.
No, that's true. I think it's a great it's a great feeling to know more about these cultures that no longer exist and somehow have influenced all of us in the Caribbean.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting you frame it like you're making history, because I think you're using that sentence or that phrase in a different way than most would, right? You are discovering a past history and you're bringing it to light. But I think it's equally applicable in the other sense of the phrase, because as you said, this is kind of an understudied area of research, right? And so not only are you making history out of ancient DNA, but you're also making history in the process of finding it and producing it.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. You summarized it very well.
Do you feel like there's other projects like this that you are also making history in?
Like with ancient microbiomes or modern microbiomes?
All of the above.
I think besides the microbiome study with the cultures from the Caribbean, the one from the mummies from South America, I think it's also, even though we do know more about the cultures, the pre-Inca and the Inca cultures, I think it's also by DNA sequencing a good way to probably not make history, but probably confirm it somehow, because we already have information. But through DNA sequencing and microbiome research, we're able to confirm what we probably already know, but in just another way of looking at history through DNA sequencing. I think somehow I'm making history that way too.
I think you're right. I feel like I've said that so many times in these episodes so far, but I think you're absolutely spot on about that. We might want to talk about it more in the next episode. But you mentioned a little bit of backlash with the journal of the microbiome of the mummy. Would you want to pursue that if you had the option?
Do you mean like pursue the backlash or?
No, I mean, I guess, but I meant more pursue the analysis of ancient microbiota.
Let me see. I think I want to. I don't think being a data scientist at Diversigen is something that I can do now. But if I would have the time and the resources, I would probably love to do that, probably with a new set of mummies or a new set of ancient samples. If I would have the access to them, I would probably do it. I would probably do it differently, because I know back then we used the tools that we had, like Chime1 and Giras. I would probably use better tools to analyze the data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I hope that opportunity comes for you, because I mean, like I said before, I am quite fascinated with the concept. While no longer at the bench with a pipette in hand, Tasha's more recent engagement is more abstract. The sense of success changes from "Is this experiment successful and did we learn something?" to "How can I best convey this information to someone who's never seen it?" Among the more standard analytical tasks, of course. No doubt, Tasha's experience as an editor with Phage Biology has informed the way she tackles these. Come back next week as we get into the possible practical applications of microbiome sequencing and data analysis.